Hi, welcome to Measure to Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument. Maybe it's ancient, or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, when it was built, why it was built, who built it, what they were thinking when they built it, all sorts of stuff. We're going to tell you so much about this.
That's right. So today we're going to talk about the Trans-Siberian Railroad.
Is this related to the Trans-Siberian Orchestra?
I did not look into that at all.
Do you even know what the Trans-Siberian Orchestra is?
No. Is it like a rock band?
They did a heavy metal Christmas thing, and it's ridiculous. I had this friend in high school, and he was telling me about the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. It was around Christmas time, and he was so excited. He's just like, yeah, man, it's like Christmas music, but then it's like rock and roll. And they're just, it's like big 80s hair metal. Oh, it's, I have no opinion on it.
This is definitely not that. I'm sorry if you tuned into this podcast hoping to listen to hair metal, but this is not it.
Yeah, we're not going to bother trying to get the rights so that we can play it, but just go on YouTube and listen to it. You can listen to Christmas music any time of the year. It doesn't matter.
All right. So the Trans-Siberian Railroad, this is a railroad that they built across Siberia.
Okay, I didn't see that coming.
No, right? So Siberia, for those of you who don't know, is basically that giant stretch of Russia that's mostly nothing. That's being facetious. Sorry. There's a lot of natural resources in Siberia. It is very cold, and it's basically that entire stretch between like Moscow and Korea.
Holy. It's like the place that stereotypically you would be sent there as punishment, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, we grew up in Alberta, so I don't know how bad it could possibly be.
Hard to believe, but it gets worse. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll start by describing it a little bit. It goes from Moscow to Vladivostok.
Right.
I'm very proud of myself for pronouncing that one. Nobody correct me, please. It's 9,289 kilometers long.
Okay.
Like the original part. Because at one part, they kind of decided, we didn't build that part quite the way that we wanted it to. So let's rebuild that entire stretch above China. The whole network is much longer than that. But yeah, almost 10,000 kilometers long.
Wow. Okay. So that's impressive. That's a long railroad.
It is so long that I feel like even the internet doesn't really know how long it is, because I Googled and the internet told me between 7 to 10 time zones.
Wow.
Yeah, that it crosses.
Depending on who you ask.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I looked at the map and I counted 7, and then somewhere in, like, it was quoted many times that it crosses 10 time zones, but I didn't see the other 3. So it crosses between 7 to 10 time zones.
Right. Okay.
There are some really informative travel guides for you to keep track of what time it is when you're on the train.
Yeah.
Because you've got the travel time, but then you've got the time difference. So it's a little bit crazy.
Okay, no, but that bothers me a little bit, because it doesn't matter what time it is if you're on a train. It's like being on an airplane. And so then you go and you take off and you have your phone, right? And then it tells you, oh, it's 10 in the morning. And you're like, what time is it going to be when I land? Well, it doesn't matter. You're going to land and then you're going to find out what time it is there.
Except it's a train where you can get off. So it's more like a cruise where, except every time you get off, it's like maybe an hour off.
Right. I don't know. I don't think that it matters that much. Anyhow, travel guides to tell you what time it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is really long.
Just get off the train and ask somebody. That's what I'm saying.
It goes through 12 regions of Russia.
Okay.
5 territories.
Right.
2 republics and 1 autonomous region.
Okay, that I'm realizing right now that I know absolutely nothing about Russia.
Yeah, no, that means nothing to me. 2 republics and 1 autonomous region. Is that all in Russia? I'm guessing.
But if it's an autonomous region, is it really in Russia? Are we talking like an enclave or?
I really should have researched this part a little bit better.
Oh.
Yeah, no, 12 regions, 5 territories, 2 republics and 1 autonomous region.
Yeah, if you don't know what that means, just Google it yourself. Can't do all the work here.
In terms of cost, it cost 1.5 billion gold rubles, which was the currency of the time in Russia. And I did look up how much sort of this translates to, which is roughly $20 billion American dollars in 2015, roughly.
Okay. That's a pretty good outlay.
I feel like it's a high number, but then if you break it down per kilometer, it would probably be cheap.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I like that. That's good. We'll go with that.
It was built between 1891 to 1904, and that would be the section that went through Manchuria. And then when they decided that they didn't want to go through Manchuria, which was just too close to China for comfort, they went around, and that was completed in 1916.
Okay.
I'm going to go through a little bit of terminology, A, because this is my turf, right? Railroads, this is what I do.
Yeah, that's your thing.
There's a lot of like specialized terminology that I might accidentally drop in. So just so you guys have a bit of context and understand the different parts of a railroad, I'm going to give you a little bit of a lesson on the terminology, okay?
Okay.
So when I talk about gauge, the gauge of a railroad is basically the distance between the two rails.
Okay.
Not every single railroad in the world has the same gauge, which means that if you have a train that crosses a border that has different gauges, it obviously can't just go from one rail to the other. It would need to change.
Yeah, so you need a different train because the train, does a train always have a fixed gauge? Or can you get one that has like wheels on a, I don't know, a sliding axle or something so that it can go on different tracks?
Yeah, there are trains that could go on different tracks. So then there's a transition point. I suppose you can put it on a different bogie. A bogie is kind of like the vehicle on which everything else rests on. Do you remember in elementary school, there'd be these like lame skateboard things that would be these square things on wheels and you can kind of sit on them?
Yep.
Yeah, so that's kind of like the bogie, and the rest of your train, car, sits on that.
Yeah, I've seen them. So again, we grew up in Alberta. I've seen all sorts of trains just like sitting at the side of the road. I don't know if that's a thing that people get to see in other parts of the world, but like it's a big deal in the prairies. You just go along and there's just like a train sitting there. And then sometimes it has like a car on top of it and sometimes it doesn't. It's great.
The gauge is important because the Trans-Siberian Railroad has a different gauge from the rest of China and Europe. So Trans-Siberian Railroad being the connection point between those two areas is completely not transferable. Like you can't traverse between them with the same vehicle.
Nice. That's good. That's hilarious.
So a little bit of a, I wouldn't call it flaw, because I think there were some thoughts that it was done intentionally as a security measure.
Trans-Siberian Railroad is like the Apple of railroads, right? It doesn't work with all of your other stuff, but it does its thing.
And it's a feature.
And it's a feature, yeah. Okay.
Brilliant. Okay. Yeah.
Now I know where Steve Jobs got the idea from.
Probably. Ballast?
So Vivian has been talking to me about ballast for, probably it's been at least 2 years. And it was just like one of those things where I was just like, I know what a ballast is. It's like that thing in a boat, that thing in a submarine that fills up, right? I don't even know if that's what it does in a submarine. Anyways, I thought that I knew what the word meant. And then one day it just dawned on me that I'm just like, oh, I actually don't know what that means in regards to a train until like just a second ago. And I was just like, but you know, it's one of those things where it's just like, I have no idea what this is. But if I ask now, I'm going to look like a real jerk. Anyways,
I'm a little bit worried that this episode is going to be filled with a lot of these moments.
I guarantee that it will.
The ballast is the rocky material that supports the track structure. So when you go into like a freight rail or rail that's in a more rural area, you'll always see a lot of rocks, right?
Okay.
The sleeper is the cross beams of either wood or concrete. So you'll see kind of embedded in those rocks, all the little beams of wood.
Yep.
So that's the sleeper, and that sits in the ballast, or on the ballast, really.
Okay.
And supports the rail. That keeps the rigidity of the rail from kind of shifting and moving.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And is this going to be on the test? Don't worry if you don't remember what all of these terms mean, because I can guarantee you that I'm going to ask, what was that again? At least once or twice throughout the rest of the episode. Continue.
Rolling stock refers to the vehicle.
Yes.
Okay. So all of this to say, in the railroad industry, we have a lot of fancy words just to describe things like rock, wood, and cars. Okay. It's not some magic. It's just like word wizardry to make it seem very confusing.
Word wizardry, pervasive jargon is what we would call that in the editing biz.
Well, there you go. Yeah. There's your jargon about jargoning. Okay. Trans-Siberian Railroad. So at first, when I started researching this, I thought it was just going to be like a long railroad across the middle of the tundra. It's not going to be that interesting. Let me tell you, this is one of the most crazy, like, how did they even build this? On a hope and a prayer, basically. There's some engineering ingenuity, and then there's just some like engineering miracle where I'm just like, I'm not sure how they did that, but it worked.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So let's jump into the history of this. Why did they do this and who did this first? This was initiated by Alexander the Third.
Okay. So not the great, but the third.
Yeah. That's one way to put it. Oh, yeah. That would suck to be a number instead of the thing.
I know.
Oh.
I don't even know. Was Alexander the Great the first one? Was he like the...
He was not Russian. Alexander the Great was like in Greece.
Really? Okay. I could have sworn that Alexander the Great was Russian. Who am I thinking of?
Catherine the Great.
Was she Russian?
Yes.
Oh, man. I thought she was English. Okay. I got to go back to school. I got to learn just some basic thing about rulers throughout the years. All right.
Yeah. Alexander the Great was also the third, but of Macedon in Greece.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. I have a post-secondary degree.
He's married to a civil engineer. Let's not forget that. All right.
I'm smart and I'm embarrassed. I have gaps in my knowledge.
All right. The railroad was initiated by Alexander III of Russia.
Of Russia.
In 1880. It was intended to connect the resource-rich Siberia and the Pacific coast to Europe.
Okay.
Initially, the route crossed into the Chinese border, and that portion of it is now known as the Trans-Manchurian Line, and that is still the route that you would actually take if you wanted to take a train from Moscow to Beijing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Interesting part about the justification for this bit, this alignment, basically. So I was reading from an article from the Scientific American, so a very well-respected scientific journal, all right?
Yeah.
Peer-reviewed and all that. This article was written in 1899, so I'm going to give it a little bit of like historical forgiveness.
Okay.
But it basically said that the Chinese, as known to the citizens of the United States, are a frugal, intelligent, hardworking race. And then it goes on to talk about how because we're so docile and obedient that we make great farmers, miners, and manufacturing factory hands.
Oh, wow.
And as a result, China is poised to be a superpower. And therefore, a railroad having farming, mining, and manufacturing prospects like those enumerated above may be supposed to have reasons for anticipating a successful issue of its financial affairs.
Nice.
So a lot of weird racial positive, but still stereotyping aside, it kind of said that it was a good idea to connect to China.
Yeah.
Like as a Chinese person, I don't know how I feel about that, especially reading it in a scientific journal. I was just like, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty rough. It has certainly not aged well.
Yeah. Also, John, would you call me docile and obedient?
I would call you the opposite of that. But I mean, you have described to me on multiple occasions, these are not my words, these are Vivian's words, that you're a terrible Asian for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
Right? And not to say, oh, she's a terrible Asian because, like, you know, it's specifically because she's not docile, she's not quiet, and those are, I mean, those stereotypes.
Not that those things make you a good Asian.
No, but those stereotypes do persist today.
They apparently make you a good Asian daughter, though.
Yeah.
Which I am not one of.
Yeah, so exactly. So it's not, anyway, not my words, not my stereotypes.
All that aside, a little bit weird to read that in Scientific American.
Yeah.
But there's the context of things. Basically, that was how they justified building this huge railroad connecting China to Russia.
Cool.
It was really expensive because it was really long. So they cut a lot of corners. Do you remember the Sochi Olympics and when they talked about some of the corners that were cut and the infrastructure was just like atrocious?
Yeah.
This was a little bit of a deja vu when I read this, even though it predates it, obviously. So they cut a lot of corners. They narrowed the foundation. So like how wide the ballast would be.
Yeah.
The layer, like how thick the amount of rocks you would put down was decreased. They used lighter rails. The number of sleepers being those wood beams that went across, they kind of just spaced them out further so they wouldn't need as much wood.
Oh, no.
So this is the foundation for your rail, right? Anybody who's been on like an old rickety train or even just like a wooden roller coaster knows what a ride would feel like if you do any of those things. You can imagine, right? It's going to be bumpy. Your rail's not going to last very long. It's steel under pressure, not being supported well. It's going to warp. It's going to do all sorts of funny things.
Oh, that's terrible.
That's basically the premise for how this was built.
Lovely.
It was built mostly by soldiers and conscripts brought in across really harsh landscapes because Siberia. So yeah, part of the punishment would be you're going to build a railroad.
Wow.
Up to 90,000 men were employed in construction.
That's quite a few.
Yeah. So basically built on just like sheer willpower. They didn't have resources because resources are expensive, but what they had a lot of were just people. So they just threw people at it.
Nice. And I find it funny, too, because a part of the motivation of building this was that there was resources in Siberia.
Yeah.
Right? Got to maximize profits, right?
So anyway, the poor construction ultimately led to some problems during the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 to 1905. Russia was at war with Japan, and they wanted to ship in equipment, material, and people across from Europe, and the frequency that the rail was under, like was used, it just couldn't cope. And so part of that war was lost because they cheaped out on this rail.
Oh, wow.
During World War II, the railway was an essential link between Japan and Germany, who were allies during World War II.
Oh, no.
So at the beginning of the war, USSR at the time was neutral. So right. They were just like, yeah, you want to use our railroad to like go back and forth? Knock yourselves out.
Yeah, yeah.
Have fun. But then Germany invaded the USSR. Then USSR was just like, nope, you don't get to use our railroad anymore.
Okay.
So there we go.
Put your foot down. You can't use our crappy railroad that doesn't work half the time anyways.
But you can't have it.
Yeah.
One interesting part is it was ultimately electrified.
Oh.
In the 1930s. This part is hilarious. So I said the railroad was electrified. And to me, that makes perfect sense because I worked on a project electrifying 300 kilometers of rail in the GTA for the last 2 years.
Greater Toronto Area.
And I talked about electrification all the time. And I think 2 years into the project, maybe a year and a half.
It was a year.
John finally asked, what is electrification? And I could not believe that he spent so long talking about this project and he had no idea what the work even is.
I am going to dispute this a little bit. So Vivian talked about RER. RER, right? Which stands for?
Regional Express Rail.
Right. And I said, what is RER? Is it the same as electrification? I know contextually what electrification is. I would dispute that story just a little bit. She did talk about something for a year and a half, as we've learned with ballasts a few minutes ago, but I did not have issues with electrification. I had issues with RER.
Which was the umbrella term for what electrification project was under. Anyway.
Yeah, it was the whole thing. Anyhow.
So the electrification of rail means providing electrical power along the entire length of the rail so that you don't need to use diesel motor. You don't need to have a power source on your train engine to power your train.
Yeah.
That means that you are saving the cost of obviously probably like a heavy diesel train, and you would have better traction actually, because an electrified train can accelerate faster. And that means that you can actually have your stations closer together and you're using less energy.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty cool.
When your trains can accelerate faster, that means you can have more trains on the rail at the same time. So you can really increase your efficiency of your rail, decrease your maintenance program, and also increase your service. So electrification is a really positive thing in terms of railway.
Right. Okay.
So it was electrified in the 30s using 3000 volt DC power. In the 60s, they converted it and changed it all to AC power. There's more optimization there. DC power, you lose more electricity as you go down the line.
Yeah.
Whereas AC, you don't lose as much.
Right.
So you're being more efficient even.
Yeah. And so DC was Nikola Tesla, or was DC Thomas Edison?
DC was Thomas Edison.
Okay.
Tesla was a proponent of AC.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. That's the history of how the Trans-Siberian Railway was sort of built. I'm going to go into the science and innovations part, which is going to go more into the hows in detail and like the how on earth.
Yeah.
Really?
How the heck?
Talk about two sections of the railway that were particularly problematic.
Okay.
The first part is going to be called the Circumbaikal Railway. And this part, actually, if you look it up now, it's considered one of the most scenic areas and scenic portion of the railroad.
Right.
And the reason for that is because it hugs the coastline of a big lake.
Oh, okay. That sounds kind of nice.
That's also the reason why it was so difficult to build. So this lake had some very steep, I guess, coasts.
Right.
And for a long time, they basically built the two ends of the railroad, but they didn't figure out how to cross this lake. Like they couldn't figure out like how to go around it, how to go across it. They had basically finished the rest of the railroad and just met at the lake.
Okay.
So what did they do? Well, in the 1900s, they used a ferry service. So they ferried the trains back and forth.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So okay. They would put the train on a ferry and ferry it across the lake to the other side.
I can't even begin to understand how that would make sense. So are we talking just like a single train? A single train car?
I have no idea how long the train would have been to get ferried across. But basically, this portion would have been so difficult to build that they neither had the resource nor the will to do it.
Wow.
So for a long time, they were just like, let's just put this on a boat, take it to the other side. It can go back on at the other side.
Okay.
For a while. And keeping in mind that this is in Siberia, the lake froze over during the winter. So icebreakers would carry the train across for 5 years.
Wow. Okay. So that, I mean, that is a bad lake if you want to get right into it. The fact that they thought that it was worth, how often did the train run? Did the train run every day?
I don't know back then, but probably, yeah.
Oh, man. All right. I got to look up pictures of this lake and we will post pictures of this lake for you.
It's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful area. You don't have to go on a ferry anymore.
Yeah.
You can just go around it.
But for 5 years.
For 5 years, icebreakers carried trains across. In the winter of 1903 to 1904, they thought, you know what? Those icebreakers were pretty inefficient, not very fast. I've got a better idea.
Okay. Jet skis?
They put the rail directly on the ice. And hauled and they hauled the trains across using wagons and steam locomotives.
What?
By horses.
Oh man. Okay. That's actually kind of sad. That's like seeing somebody and they're tried, they've put so much effort in and it's just not good. Oh man.
So yes, one winter was so bad, they laid the rail directly on the ice, hauled the train over by horses.
Okay.
So that wasn't great.
I cannot offer judgment.
I'm judging. I'm judging hard. Who thought of this?
Oh, it just makes me so sad.
So anyway, they did decide that they have to do something about this. So they started with some early planning. Obviously.
Okay.
So they had four different options to get from one side of the lake to the other. They basically chose the most economic route, although I would like to delve deeper into whether this is economic or not, because it contained 14 kilometers of retaining walls, 200 bridges, 6 stone viaducts, 39 tunnels that total to about 9 kilometers.
Wow. That's a lot. So suddenly the horses don't seem so ridiculous now, do they?
So that's it. That's why they basically just shuttled it across the lake using any means necessary instead of building this ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
But it's very pretty now that it's built.
Cool.
And you can look at pictures online. There are scenic tours that they advertise for, and the retaining walls are all using these kind of old stones covered in moss. It's like very pretty. It hugs right up against the lakeshore. It's about 84 kilometers of lakeshore.
Oh, wow. I mean, that does sound really nice.
Yeah. So it's almost like an hour's
yeah.
ride along the lake. It's really cool. Pretty.
Yeah. It'd be good.
But definitely just crazy. Yeah. So there's one part of how they did it, and I guess how they didn't do it.
That's one part of how they did it eventually.
All right. So the second part is called the Baikal-Amur Railway. So the first part was the Circum-Baikal, and this is from Baikal to Amur. So it's kind of the next leg.
Okay.
This was built in 1974 to 2003, so actually fairly recent.
Yeah.
It's a detour to shift the original route from the Chinese border.
Right, okay.
So if you can imagine where Siberia and China are, if you had already built fairly close to the Chinese border and your lake was frozen over that you can just put a train across, shifting it would mean going further north.
Right.
So the major problem of this was that they were building a railroad on permafrost.
Oof.
It's a very difficult thing because permafrost is basically soil that has been thermally stable for centuries. Okay? So it is ice. It is frost, but it's permafrost, yeah. Right? So that's not supposed to thaw.
Right.
As soon as it thaws, it turns into like mush.
Okay.
So it's ground when it's frozen.
Yeah.
But what happens when you even just construct railroad on top of that, you're basically insulating it.
Oh, no.
So then you're causing it to thaw. So you're disrupting the natural energy balance of it. It starts to thaw. The soil starts to compress. The drainage changes. And all of this just can start to move. So it's almost like a ground glacier.
Oh, yuck.
there are some pictures that I found in some old articles about this. And basically, in the before photo, you'll see this nice straight flat railway kind of built over the permafrost. And then shortly after, you've suddenly got this like massive bump of ice.
Okay.
That has like totally warped the entire railroad.
Oh, man.
Because you can't depend on it to stay level and you can't depend on it not to shift.
Yeah, that's rough.
So a major engineering challenge is to stabilize your railroad and stabilize your embankments. And I'm going to give some engineering solutions of how we do this today. But this was basically not done on the Trans-Siberian Railroad.
Right.
Okay.
So
they didn't do this. That's why a lot of it was warped. And they have a heavy maintenance program to just go and fix it all the time. The cost of maintenance has actually exceeded the cost of construction at this point.
Good.
It's about $14 billion.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So those ice movements due to the thawing and refreezing of permafrost causes what's called ice dams. It's just like a block of ice that kind of will appear in the middle.
Oh, that's so bad.
Of your railway. So you can imagine a train is going along and all of a sudden there's like a massive speed bump.
Yeah. Not so good. Not so good.
Yes. On this section of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, 75% of it is on permafrost, with only 90 frost-free days per year.
Oh, wow.
You remember how we were saying, how could this be much worse than Alberta?
Yeah.
The winter temperatures drop down to minus 60 degrees Celsius.
60 degrees Celsius. That is very low.
That's insane.
Yeah, that's terrible. We did not grow up in conditions anywhere near that.
No.
No, that's real cold.
So it's so cold that your rail, if you don't use cold tolerant steel, will fail.
Yeah.
Like your regular steel is probably just going to get too brittle and crack. Like it's not going to be able to hold any sort of load.
Oh, man.
And like I said, the moment you disturb it, so what do you do when you construct a rail? Well, you got to strip the ground of all its soil because you need to put down ballast, right? So when you excavate and you're stripping the vegetation off, suddenly that permafrost is exposed to the air. It's going to thaw.
Yeah.
Because that top insulating material is gone. It turns it into swamp.
Ugh. This whole thing sounds very difficult. That's rough. I feel for the people that had to build this.
You basically have to strip it and immediately insulate on top of it right away. You've got to have a very thick layer of insulation. So you got to build up your ballast much higher, but keep that ballast cold, right? Because you don't want that ballast to then reverse what it's supposed to do and warm up the ground. So you got to make sure your ballast has big rocks so that airflow can get through it, right? So air will actually chill your rocks and the rocks in turn will chill the ground and keep it frosty.
Crazy. Okay.
Yeah. So this is kind of some of the interesting techniques that having big rocks with gaps to allow airflow would be a low-tech solution.
Yeah.
So there are interesting things that they're doing that China is actually doing, building railroads in permafrost regions where they actually install pipes.
Okay.
At equal distance, kind of like the sleepers in the ballast to allow for airflow.
Hmm.
But then you don't want that airflow in the summer, right? Because you don't want hot air going through the rocks.
Yeah.
And disturbing it. So then in the summer, they have to go and cap all of the pipes.
Nice. Oh, okay. Cool. Well, that's rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So building on permafrost, not super fun. Also, it's actually something that we do fairly often now because there is oil up in the Arctic regions.
Right.
And a great way to transport oil is by rail. We do build a lot of rail in the northern areas.
Wow. Yeah, that is rough.
Anyway, some cool things that you could do if you had to do that, but the Russians didn't.
Okay.
All right. Some of the last things I want to talk about. The tunnels. So this railroad would not be complete without some crazy tunnels.
Yes.
Okay. One tunnel is the Douce Aline Tunnel. It was started in 1939. It's about 2 kilometers long. Doesn't seem like a lot, right?
But when you think about like a tunnel, that does seem like a lot.
Yeah. And you know, it's going to seem like a lot if you're a gulag prisoner who arrived on foot with hand tools, a horse, and a single cart to dig the tunnel.
Oh, no.
Which is the truth of what happened.
Wow. Yeah. I'm real glad that I never got sent to the gulag.
So that's weird, right? Just a bunch of dudes, some pickaxes, and a horse.
Yeah. No, that sucks.
Good luck.
That is inhumane punishment.
And do you remember that episode we did on the Via Appia where I talked about like how back then the Romans had these extensive surveys? They were really good at being able to survey on either side of a tunnel and be able to draw a straight line.
Yeah,
right?
They figured it out with the magic of triangles.
That's right. It's always the magic of triangles. Yeah, the Russians didn't have triangles, I'm guessing, because they didn't do any survey work.
I'm guessing that they had triangles. They just didn't bother with them.
Yeah. I mean, even the Stonehenge guys had triangles and they didn't have horses.
No, but what I'm saying, this is late 19th century. I guarantee Russia has given us some of the greatest scientists and...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. They probably just couldn't afford triangles.
Yeah, they just wanted to get it done.
So they had 2 tunnel teams starting on either end, digging towards each other.
No.
And they met in the middle and they were only 20 centimeters off.
Oh, really?
How did that happen?
Not with triangles.
I legit checked this over with the construction design manager that sits beside me. And she was like, I have no idea how.
All right.
So that was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
By those gulag prisoners.
But good for them.
Good for them. Just good intuition towards each other. They abandoned it.
Oh. Did they abandon it for a good reason? Or was it just like as like extra punishment for these gulag guys?
They basically sent these guys to dig a tunnel because they thought they needed the tunnel. But then they didn't have the money or the resource to finish it and like actually bring the rail up to the tunnel at that point.
Goodness.
So they finished the tunnel and then left it until 1974. So this is like, 35 years after, when water has seeped in and frozen in the tunnel. So then they have to re-excavate it, right? How did they do that? How do you re-excavate 32 tons of ice blocking the tunnel?
More gulag guys?
No, they rigged an aircraft jet engine on one end and just hit it.
Oh, wow. That is not what I expected, but I kind of love it.
Apparently, they found a lot of frozen bodies of the gulag workers in the ice.
That part's not so good.
It's so sad. And they just got jet engined.
Yeah.
So.
Ugh.
That's the tunnel.
Okay.
That's the first tunnel. Second tunnel that I want to talk about.
First tunnel really ended on a down note.
Yeah. Yeah. The second tunnel is also like, I would never expect, like before I start a job, I put together a risk registry, right? Of all the things that could possibly go wrong.
Right.
All the things that could possibly go wrong. I would never put this down.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
The Severo Music Tunnel. It's about 15 kilometers on the north end of Lake Baikal. So that's that lake that took forever to get around.
Yeah.
So this tunnel crosses 4 different fault zones that are prone to earthquakes.
Okay.
As they were tunneling, they hit an unexpected underground lake.
Oh, no.
That had been pressurized due to the seismic activity.
Okay. That sounds awful. Is this going to be like another one of those ones where we're laughing about it and then you're just going to be like, oh, and by the way.
I have no idea how many people died in this. So at least there's that.
Well, I'm going to temper my laughter.
Okay. So the tunneling team hit an underground lake that's been pressurized to the equivalent of 4 times the force of an average champagne bottle.
That sucks.
Right? So the tunnel started flooding real quick.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh crap, like, what do we do? Like, I would never know what to do here. I would,
no.
What? So they brought in a giant tank of liquid nitrogen.
Okay.
Injected it into the rocks around the leak and temporarily froze the lake so that they could have time to patch it with concrete.
Wow. That is terrifying. That is one of the scariest things that I can imagine. That is kind of clever with like liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen is like the super glue of ice, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I just would not have expected that. I would never be like, oh, we have all this flowing water. Let's just hit it with liquid nitrogen, right? But good for them. That's clever.
Actually, we do this a lot. Every time we get into swampy ground that we can't quite dig into, we just sometimes will freeze it and then you can dig it because then it's more solid.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, no, this was pretty clever. They were expecting construction to end in 1986, but basically it didn't finish until 2003 because okay. I imagine you'd have to get around this giant underground soda stream lake.
Yeah, and who knows how big that lake is. They didn't at the time.
Or how much pressure. Like, there's no way you can ground penetrate that data.
Yeah.
I still don't totally understand how an underground lake can be pressurized, but basically something about seismic activity and possibly the fact that the water was already there and maybe like the seismic activity had shrunk the area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pressurized underground lake. No idea that that was a thing.
There you go.
So that's all I have on how they did and how they didn't build the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Oh, that is rough.
Yeah. I feel like I brought up a lot of challenges and not a lot of solutions. The solutions were just, it took a long time and a lot more money than they thought they had.
Okay. You know, the one thing that I'm getting off of this, though, is that the people that were building this railroad were pretty good at thinking on their feet. Right. So they would start out and they'd be like, this is what we're going to do. And it's going to be great. And it's going to be easy. And we're going to do it for not a lot of money. And then they're just like, okay, how can we solve this without spending a lot of money? It's pretty good.
Bring a horse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So today, obviously, the Trans-Siberian Railroad is still operational.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the greatest railroad journeys that you can take in the world. It is definitely on my bucket list. I don't know if John knew that, but it is now also on your bucket list.
Yeah, no, we've discussed this. It's hard. So Vivian still has her Hong Kong citizenship. So it's pretty easy for her to go to Russia. For me, it's not so easy for me to go to Russia.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, we would have to do some paperwork.
Yeah, I got a Canadian passport. It's like extra hoops to jump through. So I'm on board with it. I would like to go to Russia. I would love to see that lake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a very, I'm not sure about profitable, but it's very well used. It handles 50% of Russia's imports and exports.
Wow.
Right now, it takes about 15 days for freight rail to go from end to end. And there's a project right now called the Trans-Sib in 7 Days project. So they want to make a bunch of track improvements to bring it down to only 7 days.
Okay.
It's costing at about 1 billion pounds.
Okay.
Which is like
quite a bit.
Two billion Canadian dollars.
Yeah. Right about
one
there.
And a half.
Pretty rough.
It involves a lot of additional track, but a lot of it is actually, well, first of all, adding freight hubs on the border with Mongolia, China, and North Korea so that when the trains have to change gauge, they can do it a little faster.
Okay.
So that is still a thing.
Yeah, okay.
They want to upgrade a bunch of ports and the terminals. They also want to let it travel faster and allow it to use better rolling stock, so better vehicles, to go up to 100 kilometers per hour. And right now, there's basically inspections that need to be done very frequently. And so they want to bring it down to be less frequent. And that way it'll go faster.
Cool.
there are a lot of branches that come out of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. So I'm sure you've noticed, because I said that it was basically done before the First World War or sometime around the First World War. But then they also added like those tunnels and those extensions. They were all built off of the Trans-Siberian Railroad later on, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of different branches that now go into the Middle East. So into Iran, Azerbaijan, and Pakistan.
Okay.
So you basically can journey from Europe to India by rail now, which is pretty cool.
Pretty good, yeah.
And one of the most exciting planned future links is a railroad from Russia to Alaska.
Okay. So it'd be like a bridge.
Yeah. So nice. It'd be like a bridge over the Bering Strait. So it wouldn't be a super long land bridge. But basically, the idea is that you should be able to travel from London to New York the long way around by railroad.
Wow. From London to New York by rail is...
Isn't it mind-blowing?
That is truly insane. I wonder how long it would take. Once they got it up and running and optimized, it would still be...
If it takes
ages.
15 days to get across Russia, I would say it would take another 15 days to get to London. And then you go up and around to Alaska. And then you got to go across America to New York.
Yeah.
50 days.
Okay.
Which
I could spend 2 months doing that.
I mean, I don't think that would be for passenger. I would say that would be for like low priority freight.
Right. But it would still be cool to do it and say that you did it.
Yeah. You know, on the Panama Canal episode, where like you can go from ocean to ocean the long way around?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like that, but
that's right.
On land,
cool.
The long way around.
There you go.
It's cool. Like there's a lot of challenges involved, obviously, but I feel like if they could deal with an underground pressurized lake, they can figure out the Bering Strait, you know?
They can sort that out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're better equipped than any one of us, really.
Right.
So that's our episode on Trans-Siberian Railroad. First of hopefully many railroad episodes.
Yeah, that would be good. I mean, you know your stuff. And I learned some new terminology that I was too afraid to ask you about.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. Please subscribe and rate on whatever podcast platform you're on. It really helps us out if you leave a rating. It just brings it right to the Apple Podcast front page every time you leave a 5-star. So please do that often.
Yes, we would much appreciate it.
Subscribe and reach out to us at Measured and Metric on Facebook, at Measured and Metric on Instagram, at Measured and Met on Twitter, and of course, our website, measuredandmetric.com. Drop us a line and let us know if there's anything else you want to hear about, especially as I am compiling the episode list for season 2.
That's
right.
It'll
be good to know.
Yeah, we've got some cool stuff that I know nothing about.
Special thanks to Astronomic Audio for editing and sound engineering this episode and all our episodes. And remember to always measure a metric.